This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Sam Swift from Voltry, who, you may not have known, got into cybersecurity by being a receptionist or a travel agent first. Sam, over to you. Tell us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, I was a travel agent, and that's very standard route to cybersecurity, as we all know. I was hacking fares. I didn't know I was doing it. Not illegally. That was a thing that I learned to do. If you understand the system, you can understand how to make it work for you within the bounds of what's acceptable. And are there three-letter agencies that go after travel agents? Maybe there were. Who knows? It's been a wild ride. This is year 26. Currently now with a company called Voltry, who I love. It's my first Series A. I've been doing this 26 years on many varied roles along the way. It's been a genuine myriad, from travel agent to receptionist, which I did for 6 months and 2 days after promising 6 months. So overachiever. I sold it. I supported it. I helped build it. I incident responded for it. I said sorry for it quite a lot. But I even sold encryption back in 2000 when no one knew they needed it. Maybe the government, well, the governments did. A company called PGP, which many of us will still remember. But it was free for home use at the time, or personal use. So trying to sell that into a world where people borrowed it for free was tough. We also sold Gauntlet firewalls, which were incredible. Layer 7 firewalls in 2000. Big, beefy things, way above anything anybody else did. At that time, people were still arguing about whether they needed antivirus. So mainly governments and the military that decided they needed Gauntlet firewalls. We also had something that was called CyberCop, which was really an automated pen test. And who knew they needed that in 2000? Like, no one, pretty much. But I thought it was cool.
I'd argue there are companies today who don't know they need a pen test for some reason.
Also true. Very, very accurate. PGP was spun off from McAfee. Missed that round of redundancies by 2 weeks. Went to work in support instead, because I was looking at moving to Aylesbury, where the support office was, the old Dr. Solomon's office. So we're going way back. I'd always had a computer. My mum bought me the first one when I was about 4 or 5 years old, because she thought there might be something in this computer lot in the early 80s. I always had one. It was something to tinker with. She had me doing QA when I was 6. I didn't know that was what was happening to me. I just thought I was playing games that she brought home, and did they work or not, and what was happening when they went wrong. Because they used to copy disks for all sorts of reasons, the company she worked at. But one of those reasons was for educational games for schools, because schools were getting their one computer. We had one at my school, and my headmaster accused me of being a liar when I said I had one. My mum said I did have one, and that was the end of that conversation, all because I knew what a space bar was.
You mentioned Dr. Solomon's. I remember when they first appeared. Their most famous giveaway was underpants at trade shows.
Yes, I remember that. Also, Solly's socks. They kept you covered on all the underwear bases, pretty much. I think I might still have some Solly's socks kicking around somewhere. I don't have the underpants, but they had some great kit. I remember doing the live virus workshop for something we bringing in customers in for. I did it 3 or 4 times. Great training course. One of the things we'd had, we'd be moving boot sectors around as part of the training. Imagine giving that to people now. It wasn't the best idea, but it was great fun. I've still got the encyclopedia that's in a book. In fact, it's probably within reaching distance of me right now, before the virus information library went online in the modern times of the internet. Before that, we had the modern times of a book that had everything in it. It's a great read. It's funny. What's old is new, and what's new is old.
I remember the days of rebuilding fat sectors because disk had got corrupted. You needed to read through, work out the start endpoint for various files. But we're going to get way sucked into this if we don't stop. Fully homomorphic encryption. Been offered up as the holy grail of encryption since Gentry first wrote the paper for IBM, well, Gentry and a group of other people. Must be 15, 20 years ago. And we've had all these excuses as to why we can't use it. It's too complicated. Requires too much processing. Too much disk. You claim that you're real-time doing fully homomorphic encryption, not just to encrypt it, but to query it, decrypt it, and use it. I'm fascinated.
In the first week of being at this company, I sat down with one of our architects. I've loved nerding out with the teams on some of the cool stuff that we've done. The amount of times my jaw dropped was many. I got onto a call with one of our guys, Adrian, who is such a legend. He said, Sam, I can search data faster when it's encrypted than when it's not. And I was like, right, okay. No, surely not. And he just said, yeah, it's easy. It's just integers. And I was like, when you look at it like that, but it's just integers. Yeah.
That's an understatement, isn't it? It's just integers. Everything in data is just ones and zeros.
exactly. It's just numbers. How hard can it be? We were going in a really big deep dive last night, which would be secret source level stuff. He was showing how we translate everything into integers and what that looks like and how it's a one-way function. It can't be pulled back. Fascinating to see thought process that goes on to build those things. You start with a simple word and how that ends up. A lot of activity happening. So when a document is encrypted, things that are happening really not just to put it into what's ultimately garbage for someone who hasn't got access to it, but then still making it accessible for people who do have access to it without them needing to decrypt it. Things get super exciting then.
And that's the real problem, isn't it? If we look at encryption today, we create something, it then gets encrypted. But every time we search, every time we move, we have to decrypt to do operations on that data. And once we've de-encrypted it, we have to re-encrypt it again for safety. So we have all these touch points where data that we tell people is encrypted actually isn't encrypted.
Exactly that. It's all well and good when it's sitting there doing nothing. And you can move it from A to B, in many cases, but a lot of times you're sending keys with it. So you're actually sending literally the keys to the castle with the castle. But the minute you want to do something, which is arguably when your data is most useful, then all that safeguard is gone. So to be able to do something data whilst it's got that safety net around it and ensure that things stay confidential, that is a huge jump forward.
And that's what's always fascinated me about fully homomorphic from the first time I started reading the papers. And that is that as I create, it's encrypted. It's only ever back in clear again if I have authority to read it. So all of my queries are encrypted. For people like Microsoft and others who've had partial homomorphic encryption schemes, they've done that by being able to do limited operations on data and very limited operations. The personal privacy companies that are out there, they use it to look at strings across country borders to get around regulators. But again, they're looking at static data with a static query. To move that to a real-time use of data, as we do today in any data scenario, people querying documents, databases, pulling stuff back, moving it around, that's a significant processing issue. What has changed to make it viable today?
This is an idea that has been around a long time, but you try and do something like machine learning over encrypted data. Yes, it can sort of do it, you know, has been able to sort of do it in the past, but horribly slow. You can say, yes, I can do this, but can I do this in a way that scales or is actually valuable to human beings? That's been the challenge. Bootstrapping has been a big change to ensure that this thing becomes performant, that it is not something that's completely unacceptable beyond the realms of, yes, I can do this, tick. And theoretically, we can do a lot of things. Can you actually do it in practice? Can that become something that the world can benefit from? I was reading something the other day that Elon Musk was talking about the fact that data was going to run out for people to have usable data that they can do machine learning, do broader AI with that data. There was a study done that sometime between 2026 and 2030 that we would hit a point where data was just not going to be growing in a way that would be useful to us because of all the rules we put around things, some of which are self-imposed, some of which are done by regulators. A lot of the regulations are also super vague. Look at GDPR, right? It's a legal text. People will try and interpret that in a way that means that they can reduce the risk of having their wrists slapped. In a lot of cases, well, they're on the side of caution. Some companies won't. Some companies will absolutely throw caution to the wind. We're seeing that play out, arguably, in real time as to what that looks like. I'm quite sceptical about regulators' ability to actually do anything. They'll start noisy, and then it always gets pared down and pared down and pared down into, you know, something that maybe some of these huge companies, they'll continue to take those risks. I digress. We have to be at a point where we can use more data to help make the world a better place. I've thrown off the shackles of being scared of companies doing stuff with my data. If it's done in a way that's going to help me now, the minute you hit send on something and you give it to somebody else, you've lost control of it. I hope that then my data is of value to back to me at some point, or at the very least, humanity. That's quite nice to do. If you think about things like clinical tests, this has been a big area where we've been talking to organisations about where they've been hamstrung by data being disparate. They can't make use of that for clinical trials. If it's something quite niche, you need to be able to get a decent data set to be able to really do the tests and analyze the data in a way that makes sense. Where we're at is being able to help organizations keep the data where it's supposed to be and still collaborate on that data without it moving and without plain text data ever flying across the internet.
When you talk about collaborate, if I look at the privacy enhancing technology companies I've spoken to, Many of them are dealing in financial services. Many of them are looking at how they ask questions of data. So, for example, I might be researching a risk of money laundering, but that's happening in a branch of the bank in a different country. I can't ask somebody in the branch to look at it because they might be the person who's enabling it. I can't fly in to look at it because there are regulatory controls, and if I flew in, people would want to know what I was doing in the branch. So they ask the question, and all they're really looking for is a yes-no response based on the encrypted string against the encrypted data. That's their use of fully homomorphic. Collaboration is a whole different level of data engagement. It's live data, changing data, constant queries on data. How do you manage that? How do you get around the technical issues with all of that?
The performance thing has been huge. This is where we've been talking about bootstrapping for quite a long time, and that's changing the game. The other piece is being able to allow multi-party, multi-key encryption. It gives people the control that they need of their data and their keys that fits with their requirements that they've either set or are being set for them by the regulators, but they can still query, they can aggregate data. They don't necessarily have to see the devil in the detail. They can get enough from that using this technology to be able to find the ghost in the machine, for want of a better phrase.
Right, before you go further, I want to roll that back. You used the word multi-key in a complex encryption world where we struggle to do single-key, ladder-based encryption because of the complexity. You are now doing that with multi-key. That's not just a level of complexity, that's multiple levels of complexity, multiple levels of processing requirement.
Yeah, I was talking to one of our teams yesterday. This is specifically around the technology we've got. This is magic. This goes back to the stuff where we can search faster when it's encrypted, which you will see on our website soon, about how we use different keys through the edges, through the data, to be able to allow for people to access the things they're supposed to access and people not access the things they're not. When we spoke last time, we were talking about keys not traveling with data and how does that all work. Multiple keys in that chain, in a way, it's a bit like thinking about it from a password manager point of view. You've got keys and encrypt keys and encrypt keys and encrypt keys along the way. That's one of the ways around it. When you've got multiple parties with their own keys, the high level is you would have somebody who is the boss of that project that says, okay, like, give me all your keys, we do all this together, but then you still control who gets access along the way. It's not, okay, we've all put our keys in the, bowl, aren't I? we've all put our keys in the mix. And now everyone can just see everything. You still want more levels of control than that. It may be, okay, well, you can see aggregated data of this project. It may be that you say, well, I only want you to see these specific fields that come back. I don't want you to see everything. And that's the magic of it, is you can share what you are allowed to share based on the constraints of the project that you're working on, the types of data that you've got. But you're not doing all of these, oh, it's magically, it's encrypted the whole time, but it's not really under the hood. And that's what we've been facing for years, is that, oh, it's only decrypted for a second. Or, oh, it's only decrypted at this point. Oh, we have to because we can't possibly get to the data. Well, no, it stays where it is and it stays encrypted, but you can still get to what you need to. And that changes the game in so many ways. Fraud, you mentioned, clinical trials, even things like trafficking. Being able to share data around trafficking cross-border is super difficult. And law enforcement agencies have been hamstrung for this for ages. To be able to do that, that will save lives, 100%. That's the stuff that really gives me goosebumps, is that's making the world a better place.
So I'm quite fascinated about this key exchange process. Part of me wants to look at this as, oh yeah, we're doing PGP over fully homomorphic encryption. Because there is the whole Alice Bob moment there, isn't there? But it's clearly much more complex than that, because it's not just about the keys. You're having a shared key manager, which you're bringing keys into, which in some ways simplifies that complexity. But you then said that you were also restricting fields. So it implies that there are shared data schemas that are then brought into play, where you're applying the security at the tuple level in a schema. Now, that's something we've been trying to do in big data for decades, and I mean decades. The closest I've come across to anything that gives me that degree of granularity and still isn't in full production is what NTT is doing with its ABE technology, attribute-based encryption. That allows me to start determining individual paragraph, individual sentence. And that's all they get to see. And they're now applying that to other things. But this is a level beyond that. Now, they have been a decade or more trying to bring ABE to market. There's a lot of very smart people in universities working with them. Are you working at the pure attribute level, at the tuple level of a database? Or what is the point at which you make that schema to key to access control?
The encryption community is a wonderful thing. It really is. There's a lot of incredibly smart people, but they don't always agree all the time. If we all thought the same thing, we'd never get anything done. We'd just be like, I've solved it. One of the approaches that we've taken on a human level is we haven't just gone down the maths route of let's just get a bunch of maths people in the room and they can all maths together and get excited about numbers. Like the guy who runs our AI /ML, and I don't like that as a phrase generally, but it sort of works for his role. The guy who runs that, super clever guy called Cal, he's come from a physics background, which you can argue physics is maths and everything's maths and we'll get back to maths in the end because it's all numbers. But we've got people come in from a load of different backgrounds that just think differently. Neurodiversity is alive and well at the Voltry. I'll tell you that for nothing. myself included. Bringing in those different mindsets that haven't necessarily gone down the same educational route to try and solve some of these problems has really helped us. Everyone uses the same Einstein quote. My favourite one isn't the doing the same thing over and over again. It's that you can't change something with the same mindset that created it. Bringing in those different backgrounds and those viewpoints into how we build this stuff out has, we're standing on the shoulders of giants at the same time. There's been some amazing work done over years. It's not just a case of let's keep trying to build it the same way. Getting a new schema through in the world of encryption, people want to know that, okay, this is using a thing I know and trust, then it's fine. If we carry on down the know and trust route forever, we're not going to change the game. Our schema stuff, some of that is in review at the moment, and it should be available very, very soon from an academic paper perspective, which I'm very excited about us releasing that. It's going to be super cool.
I was laughing when you were talking about everything goes back to mathematics. I was talking with somebody about 6-8 weeks ago, and we did a podcast on it, talking about the philosophy of AI. And I was reminded then that even philosophy goes back to mathematics if you start to go back through history and science. That was very cool.
It is all numbers in the end. She's right there in nature. Just as a side note, you just reminded me, terrifyingly, my 10-year-old child told me last night that she got ChatGPT to write a story for her. And it's the first time I've heard her say, I've used ChatGPT. I was like, oh, wait a minute. We need to talk about this.
That's a door you don't necessarily want to open sometimes.
We're going to have to now because she's in there, but I need to make sure that we've got some conversation happening around it. Both my kids have been brought up internet savvy because that's the house they live in and happened to me through my mum before the internet and had the computer, but it's super exciting, I think, times at the moment, just generally. But yeah, you're absolutely bang on. Philosophy of AI, what a great topic.
There's actually a team at Harvard working on this. They're working with NTT, oddly enough, so you might want to go and look at that if you get a moment.
I'd love to. That's super cool. But I saw quite a depressing article yesterday from my friend Rick Ferguson. It was basically saying how stupid we're making ourselves. We've got to find ways to at least be on the bus reading this stuff. I'm glad people are working on the philosophy of it because at least someone's staying clever around it. As long as we read that, maybe that'll help.
We've moved from going to libraries and using indexes, which is what I grew up with because I'm old, to people Googling things, to now people just asking an AI. But at each step, there's no retention of knowledge. It's just an abdication of knowledge. And I'm probably going to get slammed for making that statement by a lot of people.
I've got to say, prompt engineering, though, I find fascinating. Because that seems to be almost the artistic piece around it right now, is how can I ask a question in the right way? I feel like I'm still using my brain at that point.
That brings us to a really big challenge, and that's how do we allow AI access to data with fully homomorphic encryption? Because at the moment, AI is basically a data thief in most cases. There are private AIs inside companies where you're giving it data voluntarily. It's your data, you can give it. The public AIs are stealing anything they can get their hands on the grounds that, well, you put it up on the internet, it must be free. Copyright and other laws don't apply. And that's being fought through courts in multiple countries at this moment in time. And hopefully copyright people win or we get some decent accommodation. What the AI people, of course, forget is that all their code is covered by copyright. So if you want to go down this line, every piece of software ever written is accessible to an AI on those rules. But once we start to go to encryption of data And I don't mean encryption that will fail by quantum, and we'll come back to that in a minute. But once we go to things like fully homomorphic encryption, when we think about private corporate AI, it is not geared to dealing with data in that sense. It is structured around context. It is structured around how it makes connections between words, not just in a single document, but in a legal AI. It's looking across large volumes of data, multiple documents, multiple corpuses of data. So how do you enable an internal AI system, privately controlled, to access a fully homomorphic encrypted data set without decrypting the data?
This may be more of a Cal question than a Sam question. I'm going to flick this back into the searchable world.
In the searchable world, the problem is you have a question. From an AI in a searchable world, there is no question to start with. It's looking to absorb the data.
It is. We've done a project recently around training data for machine learning. It's a government type project. Got very exciting very quickly for ultimately we find patterns. If it's finding patterns, can it use those patterns to make decisions? Arguably, yes. This is where things get very exciting very quickly. It's not just a case of can we keep data encrypted and can we then have people making best use of it? The next step's got to be AI. That's where we go with this. I want AI to be better at stuff. I want it to be able to use data in a way that still respects privacy. Ergo, this is the route we're going down. It's been a fundamental of Vultures from day one that data privacy is a human right. Our data should work for us. This is where fully homomorphic is going. Can we have AI using data that is encrypted to make better decisions without affecting the underlying owner of the data on a user level? It's a brave new world. It's very exciting.
Now, the reason I chose a corporate example is because we have control of that data. We know what that data is. It's the data we've generated as a business. It may contain PII. In fact, it almost certainly will contain PII once we start to look at finance, customer data, support data. But we don't want necessarily that to be public. So does that become a point where we have a fully homomorphic variation of AI that is specifically geared to being able to know my key, therefore to be able to look at the data, but it never puts that data in clear. It holds that data in the encryption schema and it responds to the prompt engineering from the user, which again is a much higher level of complexity.
Amazing. We can take this in so many different directions. It's opening doors to things that we could never do before. This whole thing about how we're going to run out of data for AI right now. I mean, a lot of AI is arguably not great. Some of the hilarious things that you see on the internet about what did this week or today. There was a thing the other day about there was a meth addict, I think, was dealing with a bot. And it told him that because he hadn't had any meth for however long it was, that maybe he should have a little bit as a treat because he'd done so well. If we're at that point at the current days, there's a lot of room for improvement for sure. The sky is the limit with this. We're in a data-driven world. Unless it's solar flares really do take us out, homomorphic encryption is going to be the key to enabling so much of this technology to make the world better for us as humans.
To me, the extension then becomes, once we can do it for a corporate and the AI understands and can incorporate fully homomorphic, the next challenge becomes, how do we deal with public AI and public data? Because once you've got it out there, there's that constant overlap between corporate owned and publicly owned. They become those dark areas that AI can't see into. But let's turn this around to implementation. Implementation is always a struggle of any encryption schema. First of all, you have to look at what you've already got as your data. Do I re-encrypt my data? How does it work with my existing applications? What's the cost implication, processor, GPU, memory, the cost implication of storage, because now I can't necessarily compress in the same way as I used to. When you look at implementation, what are the challenges companies are going to face with FHE?
Beyond FHE, even into searchable encryption as well. You can start with a perfect world. That's how zero trust exists. Of course, you do. You have nothing and you can just build from this perfect, like, holy grail of just do it that way. And meanwhile, back at the ranch, we're dealing with organically grown systems over time. It depends what you're trying to achieve. In some cases, people will start with a project. They'll go from that. That makes things a little easier in that I've got my data. I know what I'm trying to achieve. It's thought through from I know what I've got, I know where I'm going, and I can build this thing from scratch. It's not quite the building the zero trust network scenario, but the project can make things much more simple. If I'm trying to retrofit things in, depending on the logic that's involved, one of our technologies where things are tied to identity. When I log in, there's 150 plus cryptographic actions happening the first time I log into that system, including a password manager that's giving me my key, my access to rooms and data, and how all those keys are used and generated. Remember, I said we don't have keys traveling with data. Super important. Those keys are generated at the point of login. That could be in the browser, for instance. But that logic that's happening in the background is very different to if I logged in normally. I wouldn't have 150 cryptographic actions happening the first time I logged into a specific system. So we've got to think about what changes are needed on that client side, be it a browser, be it an application, be it whatever. You do have to go back and re-architect what that looks like to be able to get the benefit of some of this technology. It depends. Welcome to cybersecurity. Depends what you're trying to achieve and where you want it to fit into your workflow. Can we go and just dump fully homomorphic encryption on everything we've got today and it just be a click a button? No, absolutely not. It's a little more complicated than that. Can we get to a world where everything under the hood is encrypted and we can make whatever it is work, be it AI, be it automation, be it an automated workflow? Yes, that's where I want us to get to 100%, everything encrypted all of the time. It makes things much harder for adversaries, ultimately. It's not just the smart math side of it, which is super cool and I love it. We look at what's going on in the world right now with our advanced persistent teenagers that are out there. Once they're in, it seems to be more and more now that ransomware isn't just ransomware, it's extortionware. They're in, they've screwed you over, and they've got your data. So you're A, trying to get back on your feet, and B, wondering what the hell is going to happen to your data and how much you're going to have to pay for it. And really, if you pay for it, are you going to get it back? Because you're dealing with ultimately criminals, and they don't always do what they say they're going to do. If we're in a world where you've got one user who has access to some data, the browser's compromised, for instance, or we can go down the what-ifs up until gone to the head situation of insider threat. If that person can only get to what they're allowed to get to and not everything's now open doors, we've made it much harder for the adversary. If we've made that data more useless to them because they've only got a subset now. They haven't got access to the entire kingdom.
That subset is the important thing, isn't it? We're still not going to have a solution to the user credential loss problem. If they've got your credentials and they're in as you, they have access to everything you have, even if it's protected by FHE. But where does that leave them? Does that leave them then changing who they target? Does that force them into a greater living off the land to get privilege escalation to then try and grab data? Or does that leave them in a world where ransomware and everything else goes away? We simply just get into teenagers stamping their foot and destroying stuff.
We've seen it before, we'll see it again, I'm sure. Making it harder generally is good. Even with privilege escalation, if we're in a world where the admin can't get to the data, the cloud service provider cannot get to the data, it's only the user that's allowed to get to that data. So you can privilege escalate all day long. Doesn't matter. Once that thing's on the server, and I do not use this word lightly at all, because I know what's coming. Louder for the people at the back. Once it's server-side, it's unhackable. Thanks for coming to my TED Talk. If you can get hold of the credentials of the user, which is commonly done, and you can find a way around that, you can still only get to what they can get to. So privilege escalation makes no damn difference. It's back to the stamping their feet thing. I worked on the Aramco breach. It was a while ago now, wasn't it? 2012? It's those moments in time when you remember what you were doing when the call came in and I was eating seafood pasta talking to my mum and it was a gotta go moment. But that went from adversaries in a network doing their adversary stuff, having a poke around trying to stay undetected, to realising that someone was onto them and having the nuclear button ready to go and 70,000 machines falling over. Not even like dominoes. They fell over together. That's the okay, right, screw you. We're not playing anymore moment. You have to think about what are they trying to achieve? And it all goes back to money in the end. It's all the Benjamins. Will they sit there and say, okay, my time bomb is sat there ready to go. If you now don't give me the money, then you lose your data or you lose your systems. Or we're back to moving boot sectors around maybe.
Is there a risk with encryption that people ignore other parts of security? You said once it's on the server, it's unhackable. We're happy about that. But we've also talked how if I get your credentials, I can have access to what I have access to. One of the examples I use when I talk to people about risks from agentic AI is that for most people, it's about it inherits all my role-based permissions. And setting aside my issue with role-based permissions rather than attributes or something else, once it's got all my roles, it's got access to all the data I want. A number of agentic AI vendors want to see the ability for the AI to grant itself additional permissions if it can't complete the job task. And a typical attack that I see coming is I get into an organization, I fire up a bunch of agents, and I simply say to those agents, get me the top 20 customers, top 20 suppliers, everything you've got on them in accounts, everything you've got on them in terms of support, all that data, package it into small chunks and send it out using steganography to a bunch of images on the company website. It would do that at machine speed. It would defeat virtually everybody's team out there by the time you've seen this happening, because it's happening at that speed with an agent. Your reaction time is so, so limited. FHE isn't going to prevent that. So how do we tie? Now we've solved the encryption challenge. And again, I use that loosely as solved, because there is another thing to do here. That assuming we have solved the encryption challenge, how do we tie that to the identity and the agentic AI challenge?
Nothing happens in a vacuum in security. You have to have all of this tied together. If you look at traditional SIEM and people being glorious database administrators, basically trying to find stuff out after it's happened. I remember going to a talk years ago where the guy presenting said basically the best way to find out if you're in a bar fight is to know you're in it. So much of what we do in security is still arguably archaeology, as opposed to there's architecture and there's archaeology. And I think that's really the two ends of the spectrum. We have to get better at figuring out what those triggers are. It goes back to what's normal, what's abnormal. We're going to learn this very quickly, I think, with agentic. And we have to put these guardrails around things, because a lot of this is arguably very fast automated workflows. It's still automation, it's still computers, it's still maths. Being able to find out what normal looks like, and if something starts behaving in a weird way, can we flag that quickly? How do we keep the guardrails in there? Identity is getting tougher. We went from, okay, we don't have a perimeter anymore, except we still behave in a way that we do. So, okay, now it's all about identity. Well, it's pretty easy to fake identity in many ways now. Is your voice your key? Arguably not. Can it be anybody's key? Arguably yes. It's never going to go away. We're never going to hang up our boots in cybersecurity and say we're all done. And the more technology advances, and it's exciting times for sure, the more we have to think about these things. Can we keep the data as safe as possible? Do we know what we've got? Can we find things that are abnormalities quickly? Who watches the watchman? Those things will not go away, and visibility will remain the biggest challenge.
Here's a thought. To me, where I see the weakness is not just the user and agentic AI, but I see a bigger weakness. And that is who's managing the key store. Particularly in the example you gave, where we're bringing multiple keys from people together. Everybody's using FHE, but that key store is the risk. I've worked secure Unix. And whilst I would never want to go back to secure Unix, such a pain to do anything. There is much value in having certain roles where you can only use a specific username and password for that role. It cannot have access to any other role. It cannot have access to any other types of facilities, such as I can't spin up an agent if I'm using the credentials for the FHE key manager store. When you talk to customers, do you have that conversation with them about how that is such a critical thing to protect?
We go down the route of many things. Of when you're setting up users, how do you send a password to somebody? There's only so far you can go with, this is the best way to do it. And then there's the usability side of it. And people will do stupid things because it's faster and can get on with their day and they'll get shouted at less.
So I'm laughing while you're saying that, because everybody who knows me when I run and I have to change passwords for people know that they're going to get their password over three separate mechanisms. They'll get three different portions of their password.
Good. One of my children's dance schools would send me a 6-character password over email every time I wanted it reset. They'd decide what it should be and they would send it to me over email. And I'm like, what are you doing? Please stop. Flipping it to deception technology for a second, I think this is actually where the two things can cross over quite nicely. If you've got those accounts flagged, for instance, and then use something on deception technology that looks like, hey, I'm the encryption key password, actually it isn't at all, and makes something look nice and juicy for an adversary, those two things can come over quite nicely. Because, yeah, if you've got accounts that never see the light of day unless it's for that very specific reason, stick an alarm bell on that. It saves a lot of problems. And not just, oh, okay, well, let's open the doors as much as possible. Let's give it admin rights. I'll just post it on the internet. I mean, fine, just be done.
So you talked about working through your schema moment. Are you submitting to NIST as one of the post-quantum cryptography options?
On the post-quantum side, and I need to make sure research don't hit me over the head with this, I am assured that we are as quantum proof as you can be. There's a degree of, you can't say you're quantum proof forever. Given the state of our schema right now, I am assured that we are quantum proof in inverted commas, that it's complex enough for what we know is coming. We're in a good spot. This thing is going to play out. I don't want it to turn into a marketing term. Everyone's going to be quantum proof. They're going to be quantum proof agentic, fully homomorphic, with a cherry on the top very, very soon. I think agentic's still winning that fight right now. The quantum computing thing is coming. It's funny, we all dissed AI for ages because an industry, everyone's like, yeah, but it's just really rubbish machine learning. You see how quickly things are moving. Oh, it's not going to take our jobs. Don't worry about it. It kind of is.
But we were told that we wouldn't get it until we solved neural computing, because the number of nodes that we needed to bring together to make that jump from machine learning to AI required neural computing to hit a certain mark. We've bypassed neural computing.
This is it. Quantum is coming, like a train. Well, not really like a train, like a quantum. We can't sit there and say, oh, yeah, theoretically, someone with a very expensive computer somewhere. We're firing stuff through 10 wormholes right now. It's still getting rather exciting. Side note, I don't know if you've seen this. I've just done crazy technology. Recall, as in total recall, for mice was something we were chatting about the other day. There's scientists that have got mice to be able to think that they're somewhere they're not. Of all the technologies I'm here for, I think that's probably it. Like, give me my recall holiday, I'm in. So we're into the brain stuff, like actual brains of animals, humans, being able to protect that data, that's super important. There's technology going on now for people who are trapped ultimately in their own bodies due to horrendous situations. Being able to communicate through their brainwaves. I'd like my brainwaves, that data, to be protected, please, thank you, fully homomorphic encryption. Not everyone's got access to a user account, please, if that's the case. We want these leaps and bounds in innovation. We have to have the guardrails around it, and we have to have technology that's going to help support that and keep people as safe as possible in the world that we live in.
But to make those leaps makes an assumption that we have a review cycle. One of the problems for cryptography is that people create a new schema, dust their hands, strap their stuff, and say, oh, look at us, look what we did. It's almost the Sheldon Cooper end of Big Bang Theory moment. We got our Nobel Prize. But we've learned in the last 20 years that hubris has bitten us hard. The same is going to happen with every current post-quantum encryption algorithm. What is the review cycle that you are looking at for your schema? Because it's one thing to say we've got a schema, we produced it. If that's not a continuous review, not we'll look at it in 5 years, then you're just repeating the same hubris.
There's the academic ongoing review that has to go on. And this is why I love the encryption cryptography community. Is such a wild and varied place, which is great. People do hold each other to account, and they do argue, and those things are good. That ongoing academia piece absolutely has to happen. There are third parties beyond that who will go and, in any situation, not just cryptography, they will review stuff for money and produce reports for you. You're absolutely bang on. We cannot just say, well, we did that. Thanks very much. I've ticked my review box. Things will continue to change. That's why we do what we do. It can't just be academia looking at itself, patting itself on the back all the time. We have to have wider review cycles beyond that. We can't just say, look how clever we are. Because, and then in practice, you get to the point where, okay, I've brought you this beautiful castle that can, let's say the word unhackable again. The thing is, people want to poke holes in it to start from a place of, this is the ideal world. What is the minimum we need to do to make this now usable? As opposed to, I can't do that and I can't do this. And, well, you're going to have to just continue to take these guardrails off or build me an imperfect system. And like, starting from perfection is a great place to look at it. Realistically, people still have to do their job. That's the password thing that you said.
It's Fortnite. I come back all the time to fifth normal form from a database. You can make any database fifth normal form. Can you produce your daily reports as an average user from it? Hell no. That's why third normal form still exists.
The more usable we can make stuff with keeping confidentiality, keeping integrity, providing security, coming at it from that angle, but thinking about customer-centric world, as opposed to, well, you just can't do that, and then people will poke their own holes in it, which is way more risky. That is a better way to build things out. And if we start from a place of data and understanding what people want to do with it, those two things play really well together, rather than locking everything down and saying no a lot and then finding out later on down the line that your no translated into a yes that you had no idea about.
So this has been a great way to spend a Friday the 13th, to be honest. I'm going to throw you one last question. It's that, what's coming down the line? What should we be worried about?
My mindset's changed quite a lot on this. I've got to what should I be excited about now? What should I be worried about? to go down the negative route, and it's true. The whole, will the advanced persistent teenagers now be going nuclear on stuff? It's a likelihood. People will try and do stuff to get money out of other people. There's that side of things. I'm excited about what new advances we can make with technology in a way that meets regulatory compliance requirements, helps people feel more comfortable about the rules that they are putting in place around data, around people, around privacy, and what can they then go do that they couldn't do today because of, I don't want to get too philosophical about what a country means, but imaginary lines that we've drawn around the world so that we can provide society. That's what I'm excited about, is what can we go do next? And if it means we can make people's lives better, we can stop people dying of things that we could prevent because we could do more with data to help understand those illnesses. It's making the world better for people. So that is going to come in many ways, shape or forms. I'm excited about Recall, not going to lie. So there we go.
Sam, thank you for taking your morning out to talk to me.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Ian.